Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you'll need to join the millions of others who have switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Odoo, modern management made simple. Hey everyone, Jody here. A reminder that for a few episodes, we are trying something cool and new, running stories that we have done alongside episodes from other shows at Radiotopia that have taken on the same topic or theme. Today, two stories about Barbara Johns and the 1951 Moton School walkout. We'll run our episode, one of our recent favorites, and then we will run an episode from the Memory Palace about the same story. These actually happened to come out right around the same time, like within a week of each other, and we didn't plan for it. We didn't coordinate with Nate, but we got some emails and tweets pointing out the coincidence from listeners to our show who are also listeners to the Memory Palace. Listeners to the Memory Palace, by the way, they are a special type of listener. Like, let me tell you a story. This is something I've noticed. When you ask someone, hey, you know, what's your favorite podcast? Like, usually people will list a few things, talk about what they like or whatever. But fans of the Memory Palace, when you ask them, what's your favorite podcast? They'll like take your hand, look you right in the eye, and just go, the Memory Palace. Like, it's obvious. That is the best podcast. Why are we even having this conversation? And honestly, it's hard to disagree. You are going to hear it here when we run Nate DeMeo's story about Barbara Johns. It is just an incredible show. But first, our version of the story. Here we go. Hello, and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, April 24th, 1951, black students at Robert Roosa Moton High School in the town of Farmville, Virginia, walked out of school to protest the conditions of their education, which were vastly inferior to that of white students at a nearby school, Farmville High School. The strike was led by a student named Barbara Johns, who pointed out that her school had some 450 students crammed into one single-story building. Tar paper shacks had been built outside to handle the overflow. No laboratories, no gym, no cafeteria. So the students walked out. And that act, in many ways, was the start of the school's desegregation movement in America. The court case that resulted from this protest would eventually be bundled with other cases and would eventually reach the Supreme Court and lead to the landmark Brown versus Board of Education ruling, which deemed segregation in schools unconstitutional. So let's talk about Moton, Barbara Johns, the first spark that eventually led to Brown v. Board. Here to discuss, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley, host of Operademics. I got to keep sneaking that in, but hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And contributors to our newsletter, which is coming soon as well. So yes, we all do lots of things. Barbara Johns, amazing. We'll get into her. This walkout, which actually I think maybe they did call it a strike. But Kelly, can we talk a little bit about just sort of Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic? You know, a place that when we think of civil rights protests, maybe we think more Deep South. But
oh, absolutely. I think we're geared, programmed, and fairly so, to see the civil rights movement through a very deep South lens. So we think of, you know, Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia. We don't necessarily think of Virginia. And I think, you know, when we covered Gloria Richardson a couple weeks back, we talked about Maryland, Cambridge, Maryland, and what it means to sort of see the civil rights struggle play out there. But similar things are happening in Virginia as well. You know, people want better schools for their children, really all across the country. That's not a phenomenon that's sort of stuck in the South. But to see this individual school pushing for this and to see parents and students getting involved in this way is quite remarkable. And I think it's something that's been left out of our textbooks, certainly left out of the public memory in terms of how we think of school segregation.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Kelly, whether one of the reasons you see this early activism in places like Maryland and Virginia or Topeka, Kansas, is it safer than in the Deep South to protest? Are you less likely to be responded to with kind of abject, overt, overwhelming violence?
I mean, safer, I might put an asterisk. You know, it's, yeah. still, it's still dangerous. It's still troublesome if pushing these boundaries. But I will say that there's more opportunity. There's a little bit more flexibility. I think being in proximity to Washington, D.C. is also interesting as well, because for a long time you had Black mm-hmm. people who were working in the government sector who were being paid similar wages. You know, Washington, D.C. became a place you could go to for economic and social uplift. And so some of that certainly spills out into the DMV area, and people are being more empowered to push for certain things, to demand certain things that there's just no infrastructure to do yeah. in the South. So the federal government does create space for people to test boundaries.
Hmm. And of course, you know, this ends up in the courts, the NAACP gets involved. The NAACP was doing organizing all around the country, but I do wonder if proximity to D.C. means maybe a little more access to lawyers and activists and people who are sort of in those circles. You know, I will say this stuff about the Mid-Atlantic's role is fascinating. I mean, obviously, both Maryland and Virginia below the Mason-Dixon line. And I was just looking at Farmville today on a map, you know, and because I know this region a little bit. I grew up in the D.C. area, and, you know, Farmville, really close to Appomattox, really close to Lynchburg, Virginia, which I know was named after a person named Lynch, but still it's like, I can't believe there's still a city called Lynchburg. Which is all to say, like, clearly the legacy of the Civil War and slavery are still mm-hmm. very much present in these places, even though they are not in the quote-unquote Deep South. And students there feel it in all the ways we were about to describe. So, you know, this school, I described a little of the conditions, a school entirely composed of Black students. The way in which they pulled off this protest and this strike is really fascinating to me. So let's go through some of the details of how they actually staged this walkout, which then led to to so many bigger things.
So the story of the walkout is a story that is both civil rights bravery and high school hijinks.
Yeah.
So you have Barbara Johns, who is the main organizer at this school, and she had become frustrated with these conditions that you were talking about. She confides to a music teacher about it, and the teacher was like, well, why don't you do something about it? And so what she does is she helps to organize the students and stage the strike. But the high school hijinks part of it comes in how they lure the principal away so that they are able to hold this strike. They have someone from outside call the principal, pretend to be law enforcement, saying that some students had been downtown, they were causing trouble, he needed to come pick them up. And so the principal leaves the school. As he leaves, Barbara Johns forges a note to the teachers, purportedly from the principal, saying that they had to assemble the student body. And as they assemble the student body, it creates the conditions that allows these students to walk out.
Yeah. And the strike is so big in that you have 450 students. And the genius of this is that while people are afraid and intimidated that they might be, you know, arrested, they came to the conclusion that, like, wait a second, the jailhouse is not big enough to hold all of us. So we might as well protest, because they can't collectively do something to all of us. And being in solidarity with that is really what made it sort of stand out. This is not just one or two people that they could throw away. They had to deal with all of the students at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happens next is also really important. I think because of those kinds of connections that Kelly was talking about, this relationship with Washington, D.C., middle-class parents who are working in the federal government, the students call upon lawyers at the NAACP. They want help in getting equal educational opportunities. And the NAACP comes back with, well, we're happy to help you with this, but it's got to be bigger than just your school. It has to be a push for this kind of not just equal space for students, that idea of separate but equal that the Supreme Court set down in Plessy v. Ferguson, but to begin to chip away at the conditions of segregation themselves.
It's worth noting that Barbara Johns is also the niece of Reverend Vernon Johns, who I think preceded Martin Luther King as the pastor of a church in Montgomery, Alabama. I don't know if he actually sort of chipped in, but certainly she has those circles and that sort of DNA in her. But I think this point about kind of the NAACP coming in and saying, because the students are, they're students, you know, and they're like, mostly I want a good cafeteria and I want gym class and I want, you know, to not be in a freezing cold in a paper shack when,
in
you know,
shack.
When I'm being taught. And the NAACP comes in and says, well, you know, there's a larger fight to be had here. And we've talked about it a number of times on the show. It's worth highlighting, you know, the NAACP is very strategic about finding cases and finding cases that they feel like have legs and are test cases. And, you know, this is what lawyers, particularly civil rights lawyers, do. But they find cases not just where there's a moral clarity, but cases where they can then feel like there's a larger fight. And so any sense of why this case in particular was like one of the first tributaries that then eventually led to being glommed together with other cases to eventually lead to Brown v. Board?
I mean, there are a lot of cases, I think, that lead to or contribute to what becomes Brown v. Board that I don't think people know about. There are even cases in the 19th century that I think are really interesting in terms of how we think of segregation and integration in the North. Mm-hmm. But I think that one of the things that the NAACP can get around is by having a case in which is so clear-cut and undeniable, it makes their chances at a victory, well, it's never a sure thing, but as close to a sure thing as they possibly can. And I think the best example of that was Brown v. Board, but those circumstances have to be so perfect in order for them to have nothing that will interfere with their chances.
And I suppose part of that is, in this case, for instance, another school in the same town where you can just do a one-to-one comparison, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge part of it as well.
And I think you also have the conditions in Moton that make it possible for what Brown really does, which it says separate is never equal. Because what happens a few years after this strike is that the Black students in Moton get a nicer school. They get a school where the facilities are equivalent to the ones at the white school in the county. But it's still not equal because the condition of separateness is part of the inequality. That's the big case that the lawyers in Brown make. So you kind of have the conditions there for tearing down the kind of basic idea of separate but equal.
And as we've been saying, Johns, when she talked about this case later on, she talked in, I think in 1988, she gave an interview and she said, you know, the NAACP lawyer said, this needs to be a fight for integration, not just against school conditions. And that was the best way to accomplish our goals. And they went for that. And there was a Davis versus School Board of Prince Edward County. And that advanced through the courts. And then along with four other cases, as we've been saying, ends up at the Supreme Court. It's Brown v. Board, which Nikki's reference to Topeka, Kansas, not just a passing reference, so that's where Brown v. Board was based, you know, but that and that eventually ends up with this landmark ruling. So going to Brown v. Board, I don't think we've talked about it on the show. You know, I think everyone knows the sort of thumbnail sketch of it declared segregation unconstitutional. What happens in the immediate aftermath of that, Kelly, and what happens in this part of Virginia is not that. It is a real fight back.
There was major, major resistance to integration. There still is. But what happens is what happens all across the country, in that there are school systems, whole school districts that basically say, we'd rather not have school. And they basically like close down the schools, shut down certain schools. There's 2 years that are just completely missing from the lives of Black students because the school district said, rather than integrate, we rather just shut it all down. And shortly after this, you get, you know, private schools and parochial schools and other alternatives where people don't have to integrate. But there was major resistance.
And in Prince Edward County, it's actually 5 years. Between 1959 and 1964, they closed down the schools. White students are able to move to a new private school that's supported by tuition grants and other donations and so forth, and Black students are left without schooling.
Yeah, and even in places where they don't have the private school option, so in Charlottesville, Virginia, they also closed down the schools for several years. The white parents hire private tutors, and the Black parents try to do the same. They try to have some form of education for their children, but they often have fewer resources in order to do so, and so that inequality is still baked into the system. And that story of the school closings helps explain why you know, 6 years after Brown, something like 1% of segregated school systems have been desegregated. So you have this landmark Supreme Court ruling, but nothing much actually happens in the aftermath to put it into action.
Yeah. And even when you do get integration, I think of like the Little Rock Nine, it's terrifying trying to send less than a dozen Black students to an all-white school and the National Guard has to be called in. I mean, that these are not at all the conditions that people expected or wanted when they thought about integration.
Yeah.
And on that point of the threat to students, I mean, it's worth noting, you know, I asked earlier if it was safer, like Barbara Johns faces threats, a cross is burned in her parents' yard, and she's ultimately sent to live with an uncle in Montgomery in order to finish her schooling. So this was not a no-cost fight that she picked up.
Yeah.
In March of 63, so as the Prince Edward County schools are shut down, there is a centennial celebration for the Emancipation Proclamation, and RFK, Attorney General at that time, says, quote, "The only places on earth not to provide free public education are Communist China, North Vietnam, Sarawak, Singapore, British Honduras, and Prince Edward County, Virginia."
Incredible line.
Pretty stunning. Yeah. And then, you know, as we said, the schools reopen in 64. Obviously, you know, a 5 years, an entire generation of lost of schooling. It takes a long time to try and close those gaps, even as there's continued resistance of other kinds. In 2003, Prince Edward County did hold a symbolic graduation ceremony for what they called the lost generation of school kids who never got those opportunities. As you said, Barbara Johns moved to Alabama. She continued to be active. She died in 1991 at the age of 56 of cancer. In 2008, a sculpture of her was unveiled at the Virginia State Capitol in Richmond. Really nice Capitol. Lots of cool sculptures there. Some of them a little dicey. Some of them about people like Barbara Johns. So go check that out if you're ever in Richmond.
Yeah, well, they're slated to. We'll see if it still happens. But they're slated to replace the Robert E. Lee statue with the statue of Barbara Johns.
Uh-huh.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That would be a very symbolic replacement.
I know.
Yeah, and then all the schools that are named after Lee and not named after Johns, we can move to those next.
No, can we do a name spot
one by
for
one.
That, too?
Right.
Oh, by the way, yeah, I was actually looking at this, that we've sort of passively referenced Moton High School. Robert Moton, really, really interesting character in and of itself, the person this school was named after, but he was the administrator at Hampton Institute, and then he was, after Booker T. Washington died, he took over at the Tuskegee Institute and ran that for many, many years as well. So maybe another person to circle around to.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson. Go check out Operademics, everyone. Thanks to you.
My pleasure.
We wanted so much here and had so little. And we had talents and abilities here that weren't really being realized. And I thought that was a tragic shame.
Okay, that's our take on Barbara Johns. Now, Nate DeMeo's version from a recent episode of The Memory Palace.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. She was old enough to know it was wrong. Barbara Johns was 15 and a half and starting her junior year at Moton High School in Farmville, Virginia. Which is old enough to know that it was wrong that the man who drove her school bus was also her teacher. And instead of using his mornings to prepare his lessons, he was getting up before the sun to drive around the countryside to pick up his students and take them to school. And then when he got there, he had to light a fire and a cast iron stove in the tar paper shack they used for a classroom, like it was the 1800s, when in fact it was 1950. And then when it rained and the roof leaked, he would try to rearrange the desks so the kids wouldn't get wet and put metal buckets to catch the clanking drips, but there was barely any room in the shack. It was more chicken coop than classroom, and he was already limited as to where he could put the desks because the stove was too hot. Kids could get burned if they bumped into it. And even if they didn't, they would just sweat and sweat, but put the desks too far away from the stove and the kids would freeze come winter. And so when the rain came, the man who drove the bus and taught the class and stoked the fires and arranged the desks in the too small shack with too many leaks and too many students had to give some of them umbrellas so they could hunch beneath them as the rain dripped and pattered and slid down as the kids tried to learn. They were all old enough to know it was wrong. Barbara Johns had been hearing about the evils of Jim Crow for as long as she could remember. Her Uncle Vernon was a preacher, famous for his persistent calls for racial justice. Most of her classmates had surely heard him too, but with respect, they didn't need Reverend Johns to tell them. They had learned it was wrong long ago, when the parents of white playmates stopped letting their children run around with them, as though there was some secret age when black boys and black girls became monsters. Or they learned it from their own parents, in lectures or stern warnings, or from overheard conversations, some whispered, some shouted surely, about the raw deal, about the indignity that one parent or the other, or their brother or their neighbor, had been asked to endure that day at the bank or the bus stop. They lived in a farm community in Virginia, where there hadn't even been a high school for black kids until 1939. And when it was built for 180 students. The white school board didn't think that black parents wanted to educate their kids. A year after it opened, it was already overcrowded, 220 kids. It turned out black parents did want their children to learn. It turned out the black children wanted to, too. By 1950, the year Barbara Johns was a junior, there were nearly 500 kids in that school, built for 180, so they put up a couple of tar paper shacks to accommodate the overflow. Barbara Johns was 15 and a half. She was a junior in high school. And if you, are an adult as you listen to this, puttering about your kitchen or walking the dog or driving your own kid to school or waiting in line for coffee before work or whatever it is you do with your life now that you are old enough to do it, you may not remember precisely what it means to be 15 and a half or a junior in high school. It's hard to when the years pile up and when you are past the point when a half year makes all the difference, when a school year defines who you are and who you get to be, which rules you live by, which ones no longer apply. What it feels like to realize that, to be half aware that you are becoming who you're going to be right then, that it is all happening, it is all about to happen. There is so much that can happen. Barbara Johns was 15 and a half. She was a junior in high school. And at her particular school, that meant she got to travel. She was an excellent student. She was pretty and charismatic and people liked her, kids and teachers. And so she was in clubs and on the student council and all those things. And so as a junior, she got to go to other schools around the state for conferences and competitions. And she would ride away from school, the smoke that billowed from the metal chimney that poked up through the black tar paper roof of her classroom disappearing in the distance, or behind a fog of her warm breath on a cold bus window, as she went off to see a little bit more of the world. And she saw just how bad her school was. It was a lousy, unworthy place. It was, of course, worse than the white schools. She was old enough to know that was a given, but the other black high schools, at least they had roofs, had heat that a teacher who was also the bus driver didn't have to generate himself with matches and kindling. She asked her parents about it. They told her about how there had been a bond initiative to build a new school. It was supposed to take 5 years. It would be a better school with roofs that didn't leak and a cafeteria. Hers didn't have one. A wood shop with tools that actually worked, where you could actually build something. But they said it in that way that she knew meant they didn't really believe it. She knew the look. She knew it wouldn't take 5 years. The white folks who ran the school board, they might never get around to making it. And what good was 5 years anyway? She was only going to be a junior once. She was only going to be 15 and a half once. 5 years. Every year mattered so much. She complained to a favorite teacher about how it was unfair and about how no one seemed to be doing anything about it. Her teacher told her then maybe she should. One afternoon after school, winter, trees bare, the sun low, she sat on the cinder block bleachers in the dirt patch that constituted their sports field. And she and five classmates, fellow members of the student council, talked about what they might do. What could they do as kids? They all shared a sense that the adults in their lives, good people and well-meaning people, didn't understand the urgency. They needed a new school now, so they resolved to start going to the school board meetings and the PTA meetings. There should be students there, people who understood, who sat in overheated shacks, who had to hold umbrellas inside to keep water out of their inkwells, who knew that 5 years waiting would be 5 years wasted. So they started going to the meetings and watching the adults. And they found them wanting. Maybe they'd been burned too many times. Maybe they'd grown so afraid they weren't going to get what they needed, that they'd gotten too afraid to ask. So they held their own meetings, out on the cold bleachers through the winter. First the six of them, and then each bringing a friend who could keep a secret. And then that friend would bring another. And as the trees started to bud and then green, they came up with a plan. On the morning of April 5th, 1951, the phone rang in the office of Boyd Jones, principal of Moton High School. A man on the phone told him that two of his students were hanging around in town cutting school and making trouble, and if he didn't get down there soon, someone was bound to call the cops. The principal hated getting these kind of calls. He talked to the boys about it 1,000 times. So he grabbed his keys, and right after he drove off, students filed down the halls for an assembly. Their teachers had each been handed a note informing them about an assembly. The notes were signed with a J, as Principal Jones was known to do, but the J was signed by Barbara Johns. And when the students arrived in the too small room they used for assemblies, they found Barbara and her co-conspirators, who asked them to sit down and politely told the teachers to leave. The doors were shut behind them. And in that room, on that morning in the spring of Barbara Johns' junior year, she convinced the students of Moton High School to go on strike. They would walk out like they were factory workers. They would refuse to go to school, refuse to graduate, refuse to participate in any program or activity until the state of Virginia committed to build them a new school and broke ground immediately. There were picket signs already made waiting in the woodshop. At least it was good for something. There is no recording of the speech Barbara Johns gave that day that led to the first student-led walkout of the civil rights movement. The strike lasted for 2 weeks. The students were prepared to stay out of school until their demands were met, pledging if they stood together, they could bear whatever trouble came. The Farmville jail was too small to hold them all, they reasoned. But lawyers from the NAACP, who had come to provide what support they could, warned them that there were other jails in the county that would be happy to accommodate them, and told them plain that the strike would not work. It wouldn't move the school board. But they offered them another way. The lawyers would help them if they changed their demands. They shouldn't ask for a new school for the black students of Farmville. They should ask to be able to go to the same school as the white students. They went back to school, and the lawyers went to work and filed a lawsuit on their behalf that became one of 5 cases that would eventually end school segregation under the name Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. We do not know exactly what you said to the 450 kids on that morning, what made them risk their safety and their school careers, what made them rally to her cause, what convinced them to follow her lead. It is lost to us now. And maybe that is fine. Its impact endures, even if it is less heralded than it should be. In any way, could a transcript or an artifact, even a pristine video of that speech in that room, capture what really happened? What it felt like to be there? To have just turned 16? To be in a room full of kids just like you? Who were old enough to know something was wrong, but still young enough to get up and do something about it?
All right, pretty incredible, right? We are very lucky to be part of the same network as the Memory Palace and so many other great Radiotopia shows, which are listener-supported and independent and all that good stuff. We're going to do a few more of these pairings over the next few shows, so let us know if you have any ideas or what you think of this project in general. Get in touch, thisdaypod@gmail.com, or subscribe to our newsletter at thisdaypod.com. And of course, thank you to Nate for letting us run that episode. And you can find The Memory Palace wherever you get your podcasts. Wherever you're getting this podcast, you can find The Memory Palace there. Go ahead, do it, find it. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.